Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Thursday, May 14th. The federal government's largest ever peacetime workforce deployment was supposed to begin yesterday. Were it not for COVID-19, nearly 500,000 census takers would have been deployed starting yesterday to follow up with residents who had not yet filled out a 2020 census form. So listeners, fill out your census form, fill out your census form, fill out your census form. Of course, COVID-19 did happen, postponing the operation at least for now. It's unclear when and how it will be safe for census takers to do their jobs in person, if at all, this year. And although this pandemic is unprecedented, the United States and countries around the world have been enumerating populations during all sorts of crises, from wars to famines and, yes, other pandemics. So join me now to talk about the 3,000-year history of the census and how it's faring in the digital age during a pandemic is Andrew Whitby, data scientist and author of The Sum of the People, How the Census Has Shaped Nations from the Ancient World to the Modern Age. Andrew, Dr. Whitby, welcome to WNYC. Thank you so much for coming on with us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Your personal history and census history intersect. You write in the book about how you learned about the term census from the Bible. So for listeners who might not be familiar, who is calling for a census in the Bible and what happens next?
Yeah, so there's actually a lot of censuses in the Bible. The book of Numbers is basically named that for a bunch of Old Testament censuses that happened. But the one that I think is most familiar to people, the one that I definitely encountered in early life myself, was the census that's related in the Gospel of Luke. And that's the census that happens as the kind of backdrop to the nativity story. So the reason that Mary and Joseph, the parents of Jesus of Nazareth, are traveling to Bethlehem and end up Jesus being born in Bethlehem is because there had been a census decreed by Caesar Augustus and the governor of the province there, Quirinius, which required them apparently to travel back to their sort of ancestral home, which was Bethlehem. So that's the first census I think that I encountered in my life as a young person, listening in a chapel, a school chapel.
And in the book, you go way back to ancient times, even before the Bible, to proto-literate civilizations who were doing something like a census. How did some cultures do a census when they didn't have a sense of written language or maybe even numbers?
Yeah, exactly. So in the introduction, you said 3,000 years, and that's a sort of conservative estimate, right? I mean, once you start to go back too much beyond that, you get into this realm where things are not written down so well, or the historical record is itself much later than the events that are being described. But we definitely have examples of cultures where, censuses were taken by perhaps collecting a token from each person. So there's an example in the Old Testament of each person having to give a half shekel, which was sort of, presumably used in some way to count. And even much more recently in societies that didn't have writing. So in the Inca society in pre-European America took censuses, and they recorded this sort of elaborate data using these things called quipu, which are basically strings that are kind of tied together and have knots tied in them to represent digits in particular places, much like our decimal writing system today. So it was certainly possible before writing, but it becomes much harder to know exactly what happened if we don't have, good narrative records of what went on.
What were they looking for?
In Inca times?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that seems to be mostly taxation. So the two things that really guided censuses, that really motivated them initially, were sort of taxation of money or, the produce that you might produce, or alternatively taxation of your own labor. So for military conscription, most obviously, which is the case in a lot of the biblical censuses, or for sort of civilian conscription to build things like dams and levees and irrigation systems and maybe pyramids, that kind of thing.
In terms of global history, census taking didn't serve the same purposes that it does today in the United States. You just gave us one example from Inca civilizations. You know, we use it now to determine the number of seats that each state has in the U.S. House of Representatives and distribute hundreds of billions of dollars in federal funds to our communities. That's why there's such a big push every time there's a census, which is on the tens, in case anybody doesn't know that, in this country, 2010, 2020, et cetera. That's why there's such a big push. There's so much at stake in terms of dollars and in terms of representation in Congress. What was the census typically used for in other societies?
Yeah, so I sort of describe in the book this transition from that early period where, you know, it was not wholly and only used for those things of conscription and taxation, but it was very much this kind of oppressive thing. It was that your ruler, your king would come and take a census of you, and it probably didn't benefit you in any way, right? You were almost certainly going to lose out from being recorded. You'd try and avoid being counted if possible. So it means that, you know, even the numbers that we do have from those early periods, you have to take with a lot of grains of salt, because there probably were a lot of people who were not counted. But then gradually there was this tradition, that this transition towards the census being used in ways that benefited people. So as governments became a bit more benevolent, I guess, you have censuses in the sort of 1700s and 1800s, which start to be taken for the purposes of providing things back to citizens, back to the people that they were counting. And that's the situation, as you say, that we have today in the United States.
So listeners, to be very clear, we're taking this opportunity of Andrew Whitby's new book about the history of the census as an excuse. One, as an excuse to have this conversation about this really interesting history, but also as an excuse for us to say, fill out your census form, fill out your census form, fill out your census form if you haven't done it, because this army of census takers that was supposed to be deployed yesterday as the largest federal government workforce other than the military in U.S. history is not going out because of the virus. So fill out your census form, fill out your census form. You can go to 2020census.gov. There's also an alternative address that I believe gets you to the same place, and that's my 2020census.gov. So if making it personal makes it easier to remember, my 2020census.gov. You know what I'm curious about? You know, you talked about kings and dictators using it to oppress their people. The U.S. Census is written into the Constitution of this country. Why was the census so important to the framers?
Yeah, so if you think about the reasons for the American Revolution, you know, we have this idea of taxation and representation, that they should be linked in some way, right? That if you're paying taxes to a government, you should have some say in that government. And there were lots of ways of doing that, right? You didn't necessarily need to do it on population, but the framers kind of seized upon this idea that the fairest way really of trying to apportion both at the time direct taxes and also representation in the House of Representatives would be based on the population of the colonies and the states that would constitute the United States. And I mean, they didn't get it quite right initially, right? They, at least by modern eyes, the initial census clause is kind of hobbled by this three-fifths compromise, which counted African-American slaves as three-fifths of the same count as free white people in the U.S. But that basic idea of tying population to representation is something that sort of caught fire and has you know, is now kind of the standard way that we think of democracy around the world.
And of course, the Trump administration has been mired in controversy over adding a question that would have asked about citizenship in the 2020 census. I've seen some of the TV public service announcements for filling out your census form, and they make a big point of saying the census has no citizenship questions. So for anybody listening right now who still might be uncertain about that, there is not a citizenship question on the 2020 census. Don't let that be an impediment to filling out your form. But there have been questions relating to citizenship on the U.S. Census for many years throughout the country's history. So looking at the census form for 1920, for example, citizens were asked, can the person speak English? And person's mother's mother tongue. You don't usually see the word mother come up twice in a row, but it did on that census form question in 1920. Person's mother's mother tongue. So when did the United States first include citizenship questions and why?
So the first citizenship question on a U.S. census, I think, or relating to citizenship was in 1820. And my understanding is that was sort of a residual worry about foreigners and citizenship issues following the War of 1812. And then those questions kind of they came and went, and they changed in form over decades in the census. But we haven't really asked a citizenship question of everybody or even close to everybody since the second half of the 20th century. And that was a kind of intentional change because the census realized at that point that they were undercounting people, which is, you know, still a huge problem today. And so they started to make the census that everybody filled out much shorter in content and sort of remove things that might dissuade people from answering, which is why we have such a sort of simple census today. The idea is that we want to count as many people as accurately as possible rather than necessarily collecting all the possible information that we could.
You know what? If you think our audience isn't nerdy or interested in history, our board is completely full with callers. All our 10 lines are lit with people who have questions about the history of the census. So here is, well, you mentioned census in the Bible, and Amy in Manhattan has a question about that. Amy, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, Brian, and hello, the guest. The census said that Moses took was not the entire population, but just the adult males.
So yeah, that's right.
You know, sometimes I wonder how much you could extrapolate from that. You know, I would think it'd be like total about a million and a half or so.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry.
Go ahead. No, you go.
I was going to say, yeah, in the book I talk about these early censuses, and you're right, they were adult males. There were censuses, the ones under Moses anyway, in the Book of Numbers, for sort of military purposes. And so because that, you know, the military then constituted men of a fighting age, that was who was being counted. Demographers can kind of extrapolate in a rough way. You know, if you have a certain number of men of, you know, pick your age range, 16 to 40 or something, then you can kind of say, well, what would the structure of a population have looked like, you know, before modern medicine and all those kinds of things? And you can extrapolate that to a complete population. So that's something that I do in the book. But it's rough, right? I mean, you can't say, you know, is it 2.5 times, 3 times, 4 times that number is the total number that you might expect of a population. But there's a process like that that you can follow to get an approximate estimate, yeah.
Anita in Ghent, New York. You're on WNYC. Hi, Anita.
Hello. I am an artist who was commissioned to do the entire landscape of the new Census Bureau building in Washington, in Suitland, Maryland, for the 2010 census. And in order to come up both with a concept for what I was going to do, which was to represent the diversity of the United States population according to the symbols, the symbolic abstract numerals of what census is or was, the counting system rather, I needed to actually access as well the Native American counting system, which unlike other world cultures has numerical representations of systems, counting systems. The Native people use a digital system, which was hand-based. So, for example, the number one would have been that finger pointing up, and the number nine is all but one. In the research that I did, I also learned that census was taken in the West of the Native American people by the United States government, and they were actually represented through drawings of tree branches so that stick figures such as families were represented by a Y-shaped twig for a woman, a plain stick for a man, and then a number of little sticks. And each family was represented by these various kinds of branches.
That would take a lot of space once the population is big enough. How did they handle it?
Well, they were just sheets of paper. that I found. They were sheets of paper that had family one, family two, and then just little stick figures next to it.
That's so interesting. Do you write about anything like that in the book, Andrew? Were you aware of that from Native nations in this country?
Yeah, one example that I do write about is from the 1620s when the Virginia colony was just getting going. This is the time of sort of the legend of Pocahontas that, you know, a lot of people are familiar with, have seen the Disney movie and so on. But there was when Pocahontas went to Britain, she was accompanied by a man called Uda Matamakan, who was delegated basically to go and do a sort of demographic espionage on the British who had come to America and see, you know, how many they were, what was the strength of this nation. And the way it was reported, admittedly, by British Americans then writing about it, was that he carried this stick and would carve a notch in it for each person he saw, which sounds kind of unrealistic, right? I mean, you'd very quickly run out of space on a stick. But there's actually evidence that that the Powhatan people had a kind of decimal system that they could use in that way. So it's possible that you could accumulate quite a large count of people in a way like that. But yeah, certainly these methods of counting existed, and counting was useful in all kinds of societies of different sizes and with different degrees of writing and calculation and so on.
Lloyd in Manhattan has a question. You're on WNYC. Lloyd, hi.
Hi. People don't realize that the census is a primary source of genealogical information, so that if you don't fill out your census form, your descendants will not be able to trace their ancestry.
It's a great point, Andrew. People, I don't know if not be able to trace, but certainly the census data is used all the time in genealogy, right?
Yeah, that's right. I describe actually my own journey of trying to use Ancestry.com, which is one of these big genealogy sites, to try and trace my ancestors who I'm Australian, but my ancestors come from Britain mostly originally. It was fascinating to do this and trawl through, census records. And then you can even go beyond before there was a census in Britain. The first one was in 1801, and go back to kind of birth and death records and so on. So yeah, I think it's really important for that purpose. And the census forms that people fill out today, are confidential, as everybody continues to sort of remind people. You reveal your information, it goes to the Census Bureau, it won't come out except in a very aggregated statistical form to the rest of the world. But that's only true for 72 years. After 72 years, those census records are released to the National Archives, and then they become available for people to do that kind of historical research. So yeah, it's both something that contributes to our current good government, but also it leaves that record for future descendants.
Joe in St. Albans, you're on WNYC. Hi, Joe.
Yeah, hi. Good morning, guys. While the census does not have a citizenship question, it does have a racial question. And I'm in a biracial marriage. My son is biracial. My grandkids are even further biracial. So within that context, I always sign that section, whether it's on the census or other forms, human being.
But they do get specific enough now that you could put biracial for your son, if your son lives with you, because it's by household, things like that. Why wouldn't you do that?
It bothers me. I think we're all human beings. I don't see color. I don't see accent. I can't hear an accent. They're either citizens or they're trying to be citizens. And sometimes the non-citizens I worked with were better citizens than the citizens I worked with. It's just a thing with me. Mm-hmm. It started with my son when he went to Catholic school. The form that they gave me at the beginning said that, and I wrote in human being, and the sister that accepted the form at the desk looked at that and she laughed. And the next year, there was not that question on the form.
Joe, thank you for your call. I'll bet, though, Andrew, that if the census could ask the race of people who refuse to put down their race on the census form, they would find that most of them are white.
I have no idea, honestly. I think it's you might be right. I think it's the case that a lot of people of any sort of racial self-identification feel a bit uncomfortable having to necessarily, you know, define in this kind of statistical way that the Census Bureau asks of people. And I fully understand anybody, you know, writing down whatever they feel comfortable with on that question. The guidance from the Census Bureau is pretty brief, so you kind of have that freedom.
The question is, for any society that includes any kind of racial or ethnic question on a census form, are they using it to enable discrimination by the government, or are they using it to aid inclusion, as the U.S. government, at least in modern times, says it's doing?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The race question gets asked on the census and other similar statistical forms here precisely so that we can measure outcomes in society that might differ based on race or ethnicity, and that kind of can highlight underlying problems that we can look at addressing as a society.
Before you go, 2010, the H1N1 flu, also known as the swine flu, was in full force in the United States. How did the Census Bureau approach taking the census that year? Did H1N1 impact the fullness of the census count in 2010 at all? And were there lessons from that we can apply this year, even though obviously this year is more extreme?
Yeah, so as far as I'm aware, unfortunately, there really weren't. So there were some contingency plans, I think, available to the Census Bureau because they were doing planning when H1N1 was in full force, as you say. But by the time it actually came to the count in 2010, I think more or less the main period of that had passed. So I don't think it really had the severe impact that we're seeing COVID have on the 2020 census. They kind of are in uncharted territory as far as modern censuses go this time around.
And you write that only 60% of households are currently expected to self-respond in 2020, down from the 64% achieved in 2010. So before I conclude this segment by giving the title of your book again, I will just say, listeners, fill out your census form, fill out your census form, fill out your census form, and get everybody to fill out their census form, fill out their census form at my2020census.gov, my2020census.gov. And we thank Andrew Whitby for such an interesting segment of census history. The Sum of the People is his book, How the Census Has Shaped Nations from the Ancient World to the Modern Age. Thank you so much.
Great talking to you.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is obviously also a daily coronavirus podcast. Under the circumstances in our country right now, we'll keep staying on top of things to serve you the best we can. And remember, this podcast is excerpted from my live weekday call-in show, The Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to be a caller or just hear it live, it's from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on WNYC Radio in New York, or online at WNYC.org. You can also tweet a question at us anytime. Just tweet at Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening today.